You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. I'm David Ermello, credentialed reporter and the host of Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Please make sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get the latest episodes. Today's episode is brought to you by rockauto.com. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. That's rockauto.com. It was a game that was ugly, sluggish, and had some tough officiating for both teams, and ultimately came down to the wire after Miami held a 9-point lead with less than 2 minutes. I'll recap the game and answer your questions as the Heat came away with a 116-114 win to take a 2-0 lead in the series against the Milwaukee Bucks. The score was 111-102 with 143 left in the game. Giannis Antetokounmpo would score the next 5 points to cut the lead down to 4. A Bam Adebayo jumper pushed the lead back up to 6, but Giannis would again score with just 15 seconds left in the game and a score 113-109. On the ensuing inbounds play, Jimmy Butler was forced into the corner and he wound up throwing the ball back towards the Bucks basket, almost converting a shot in the process. Brook Lopez would rebound the missed pass attempt, whatever you want to call it, and score to cut the lead down to just 2. Jimmy Butler was fouled on the very next possession. He would hit just 1 of 2 free throws with 7 seconds left on the clock. And after a Bucks timeout, Chris Middleton, who had scored 23 points on the night for Milwaukee, would draw a really questionable foul on Goran Dragic from 3-point range while in the act of shooting, and he would convert all 3 free throw attempts. And with just 4 seconds left, Jimmy would get the ball once more from the corner as he rose up to shoot, was lightly pushed in the back by Antetokounmpo, resulting in his 6th foul. Antetokounmpo was fouled out of the game, and after review, the referees awarded Jimmy 2 shots with no time left, nobody at the line because of the expired game clock, and Butler knocked those both down to seal the win. It was as unpredictable a playoff game as you might hope for, with both teams playing really aggressive defense, getting key buckets and key moments at just the right time, and questionable officiating that left both teams, but mostly the Bucks, upset after the game. Jimmy Butler spoke to media, talked about the foul on Giannis to seal the game. He acknowledged that it was a foul. It didn't look that way, to be 100% honest with you. I think foul on Dragic against Middleton was particularly questionable. Goran held his ground, had his arms straight up in the air. I didn't see any kind of contact whatsoever. Doris Burke, who was on the color commentator for the game, also acknowledged that there was not much contact. The referees decided that it was a foul. Again, Middleton hit all free throws to tie the game. And then as far as the Butler shot attempts, he was kind of fading away in the corner. Didn't look like he was really sure of what to do next. It probably would have gone to overtime. And then Antetokounmpo put a hand on Butler's back, kind of side more than anything else. And it seemed like there was some contact. There absolutely was. Just, I don't know if it was enough to make it a foul call. And Eric Spoelstra wasn't critical of the referees after the game. Mike Budenholzer, the Bucks head coach, was. So it's clear that nobody was really satisfied. I think the Heat can be a lot more content knowing that they walked away with a victory. But there were definite issues with their late game execution that I'm sure Miami will have to focus on over the next day before Game 3 takes place on Friday afternoon. My key takeaways from this was that it was a very different win than Game 1. Jimmy Butler took a 3-point attempt early in the game, and it seemed like that was kind of the barometer for the rest of his night as far as his scoring was concerned. He was very quiet offensively, finished with just 13 points, 3 of 8 from the field, to go along with 3 rebounds and 6 assists. This was in 36 minutes of play. Conversely, Giannis Antetokounmpo, who was criticized over the last 48 hours after that Game 1 loss, had a huge game as you expected he might. He was much more aggressive, finished with 29 points, 10 of 18 field goal attempts, 9 of 13 free throws. So he was hitting his shots at the stripe. And he also added 14 rebounds and 3 assists. Now, 7 Heat players, led by Goran Dragic's 23 points, scored in double digits. Dragic, Butler, Crowder, Bam Adebayo, Duncan Robinson, all 5 starters, plus Kelly Olynyk and Tyler Herro, who combined for 28 points off the bench, more than all of Milwaukee's reserves combined. And while Middleton had a big game, and both Brook Lopez and Eric Bledsoe, who returned to action after missing Game 1, both scored 16 points each, Miami's depth absolutely proved superior. And that was the biggest difference, especially on a night when Butler wasn't looking to be aggressive with his shot, nor did he have to be. Perhaps Jimmy Butler's greatest ability is to be able to gauge what's necessary over the course of the game. In game one, he saw he had the opportunity to score late in the game, especially with Wes Matthews inexplicably out for most of the fourth quarter. In game two, he was focused on putting defensive pressure on Milwaukee's key scorers, setting up teammates, and recognizing when he needed to get a bucket. He did finish with 8 free throw attempts, or to make plays for others, and it absolutely paid off. If there's a knock on Giannis, aside from his inconsistent shooting, is that he tries too hard to single-handedly win games and doesn't always seem to understand the nuance yet of when to turn it on or off. Credit to him with being good enough so that it doesn't always matter, but against a team like Miami, as deep as they are, this is more about knowing when to use the hammer and when to use the surgeon's scalpel, and that's something that Butler has innately understood since day one. I've made this point before, but it bears repeating, especially after a win like this. This team's depth has long been a strength, especially over the last few seasons. The difference now is that there wasn't a player like Butler before, who you could go to in key situations like at the end of Game 2. And over the course of 48 minutes, you were relying too much on either Goran or Josh Richardson or Dion Waiters to get you a key shot, and you didn't have a Bam Adebayo who could change the game with his constant activity and all-around effort. Both before and after Game 2, Jimmy reiterated that while his scoring in Game 1 got a lot of attention, he knew he didn't always have to be the lead scorer. On Wednesday, it was Goran with 23 points, nor does he always want to be. And while some were dismissive of Jimmy's comments as just gassing up teammates, the reality is that it's paid off all season long. Everybody knows their role. Everyone stays ready. And between the versatility and the sheer number of scorers on the roster, it makes this team very difficult to beat. Aside from all that, the officiating was an obstacle. And while I was angrily tweeting at some of the calls during the game, the truth is that it mostly evened out. The Heat were called for 26 fouls, the Bucks for 25. Miami shot 32 free throw attempts and they hit just 25 of those, while Milwaukee shot 39 attempts and made 33 of their attempts. Some of the calls were egregious, and they seemed to kill a lot of the momentum that both teams were looking to build. If there was a criticism of that, it's that it always seemed like Milwaukee would get a bucket at just the right time as they were clawing into a Miami lead and somehow draw minimal contact that would lead to free throw attempts. And while it impacted the end of the game, again, I would say that it mostly evened out. We tend to consider of late how the bubble affects shooting and mental health, and for empty arenas with players on both sides chirping loudly, it's got to be very difficult for officials to call these games. It can't be easy. Mistakes are made, as they always are, even during the regular season, but I'll always acknowledge something that Matt Moore of the Action Network and Locked on Nuggets has said for years. Officiating is like an act of nature. You can't control where lightning strikes or when the wind blows. You have to adjust and move on, or you'll just get blown away. And in Game 2, Miami made the necessary adjustments after being in control for most of the game and having that lead slip away. That's resilience, and that's a sign of a mature, well-coached team that's ready for a deep playoff run. I'll get into some more takeaways and answer your questions about the game, so stay listening to Locked on Heat. With the ever-increasing numbers of makes and models, it's impossible to stock all the parts you need in a traditional chain storefront. Why endure pointless, intimidating questioning and wait while the person at the counter orders the parts in their computer, choosing the only brand in the warehouse that happens to carry it? You have computers with access to rockauto.com at home and in your pocket. Chain stores have different prices for professional mechanics and do-it-yourselfers. Rockauto.com prices are the same for everybody and are reliably low. It's a family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. That's two decades of service. Go to rockauto.com to shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. They have everything from every part that you could possibly imagine. You just go on your website. It's so easy to find and navigate through. It's just a few easy clicks and it's delivered directly to your door. RockAuto.com's catalog is unique and, again, remarkably easy to navigate. All the parts are for your car or truck. And best of all, RockAuto.com has reliably low and the same prices for either professionals or do-it-yourselfers. Why spend up to twice as much for the same parts? Go to RockAuto.com right now and see the parts available for your car or truck. And then you go to the section that says, "How did you hear about us?" and write "Locked On" so that they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. That's RockAuto.com. Subscribe to the show on your favorite app to listen to podcasts and always get the latest episodes by asking your smart device to play Locked on Heat when you get in your car to get your team every day. I always do the good, the bad, and the ugly after every game, and I'll continue to do so. The good today, Goran Dragic. I brought it up after game one because, of course, he's been such a consistent scorer throughout the playoffs, and it seems like it has not stopped. I keep wondering when the other shoe is going to fall when it comes to Goran, just because of his age, because I'm not sure if somebody's somehow going to find a way to defend Goran and keep him from getting the looks that he's been getting. But even with Bledsoe, who has some experience guarding Goran back from their days while they were on the same team on the Phoenix Suns, I thought Bledsoe would do a pretty good job of limiting what Dragic could do in a way that George Hill, who started game one, could not. It didn't seem to matter. Even with Bledsoe in the game, Goran wound up scoring 23 points, 8 of 18 from the field, 4 of 8 from the three-point range, and 3 of 4 from free throw line. So he was clearly engaged, still ready to go to a shot. One of the things I liked from Goran early was, as you well know, or as you may not know, Milwaukee's defense is very key to limiting paints in the point. One of the key impacts to that is Brook Lopez, who at 7 feet one, I think, is able to swat a number of shots. He's turned himself into quite an incredible defender over the course of his career. He started off as mostly just a scorer who could not defend very well and has since evolved to much more than that. Now, he drops in coverage, which means that when you have the initial ball handler on the three-point line, he tends to step back, knowing that that ball handler is going to try to get past that initial point of contact and get to the rim to put up a shot. But Goran is crafty enough to be able to use the floater as well as I've ever seen over the course of his career. He seems to have the timing and the location of his shot perfectly, where he was arcing some shots off the glass incredibly high, and those were able to drop at a rate I don't think I've ever seen before. And moreover, I have to say, Goran just looks so determined, more determined than I've ever seen him. And I think a big part of that is that he recognizes that this team is a legitimate title contender. And it's tough to say. I think he's pretty open about it. You should definitely check out a piece that I tweeted out over the last couple of days from Joe, I'm probably butchering his last name, I want to say Bigweristan, who is a writer for Heat.com, and he does a very good job of doing some question and answers. And this one, he did a Q&A with Goran, who acknowledged what his tenure in Miami has been like. You know, he's been through some really up and down years, and of course the Chris Bosh injury the year after he was acquired by the Heat, and the fact that the team has gone through so many different iterations with Dwayne Wade staying, then leaving, and then coming back, and so much has really changed about this Heat team and the composition and everything else. Another key factor as far as what maximizes this team's depth is now they have, well, at least over this season, they've been very, very stable. They've had some very good players, all of whom understand their role. That hasn't been the case over the last few years of Goran's tenure here. He's also evolved into a much more complete locker room leader. And it's something I'll never forget when I wrote a profile of him a couple of years ago and talking to him for a few minutes and seeing how difficult he acknowledged his language barrier being in that locker room and not feeling 100% comfortable stepping up and telling guys, but he's been here long enough. He knows exactly how to play. And for Jimmy to have given him the vote of confidence from day one, Butler, I got to say, for all the criticism, and we keep talking about this, but for all the criticism of who he was like in Chicago and Philadelphia and Minnesota, man, he understands how to press buttons. He really does know exactly how to get the most out of people on this roster. And I think his friendship with Goran is a genuine one, but he also knows that Goran is a hell of a player and a very tough competitor, and that's the kind of person that Jimmy just gravitates towards. So I love that partnership. I love how Goran has taken yet another step over the course of his incredible career, and his determination just seems like it's so laser locked in at this point. And I think he really does see title aspirations for this group. I'm not sure what his future is like. I'm not sure if it's here in Miami or elsewhere, but at least this season he has shown incredible levels of resolve, and again, just the ability to focus and to contribute at such a high level despite his age, despite the challenge of coming off the bench. You cannot say enough about Goran's performance in the playoffs. Now, I'll also give some credit to Derrick Jones Jr. Obviously, Derek has been out of the lineup for most of the playoffs and the 8 seeding games prior to that. His timing has been a little off. He was, of course, diagnosed with COVID-19, and it's been a little difficult for him to round the form, and he hasn't always been able to make contributions aside from his defense, and even his defense has been somewhat spotty at times there. Andre Iguodala wound up getting hurt at some point during the game when he stepped, I want to say, on Kyle Korver. I think Korver closed out on an Iguodala three-point attempt and went under Iggy's foot, and then he twisted his ankle. He was limping pretty badly, and it looked like he was going to be taken out of the game, but he had to knock down those free throws, knock down two of them, and then limped off the floor, and we weren't quite sure what his status was for the rest of the game was going to be. More on that later on. But then Derrick Jones Jr. was inserted, mostly for his perimeter defense, to throw another big body at Adetokounmpo to try and limit what he can do. And that did not look like it was going to be going very well. We weren't quite sure what he was going to be able to provide against Adetokounmpo. Giannis seemed like he was just determined to bull past the much skinnier, thinner, and less powerful Derrick Jones Jr. And he did very early on. But then eventually, Derrick, to his credit, really seemed to figure out his timing and made some really impressive defensive plays. Got three blocks in the game and a steal. Seemed to shift his feet well. Knew how to get a hand in there. I think he was able to interfere with a couple of shots from Brook Lopez as well as Adetokounmpo, who was his primary assignment. And he was able to help at just the right time. And in 7 minutes of play, he was a plus minus minus three. Not his fault, I think, in the sense that he was making the kind of contributions that were expected from him. And this is the kind of defense that he's capable of playing that we had not always seen in the Orlando bubble. So for him, a very positive showing. Glad to see that he was able to get some contributions. Of course, I talked with Wes Goldberg prior to the Milwaukee Bucks series about Derrick's likely lack of playing time in game one. Obviously, he didn't get any kind of time whatsoever. And in game two, he stepped up. Now, the bad, unfortunately, is that Andre Iguodala looks like he'll probably be missing some time. Now, if you watched the game, you saw that Andre came back after getting some treatment in the locker room, and he told Coach Spoelstra that he was ready to come back out on the floor if necessary. Spo chose not to play him. I'm not sure if it was absolutely ever necessary for Iguodala to get out there because Jimmy Butler wound up coming back in the game and making his usual defensive impact, as well as Bam Adebayo and others. Iguodala was at least available, but it tends to happen with these ankle sprains, and that was the diagnosis, at least as reported by ESPN, was that these ankles tend to swell up over the next couple of days. And given Andre's age, given, you know, the wear and tear on his body, I'm not so sure what his status would be. If I had a guess right now, I'd say a game three appearance is not likely. Maybe they can tape it up. Maybe he can get the kind of treatment he needs. Maybe he knows at this point in his career also how to exactly respond from these kind of injuries. But it looked bad. He was limping pretty noticeably. And he's a pretty tough character who I think has gone through a lot over the course of his career. And for him to show that kind of pain as obviously as he did in game two, I don't think it's a good sign. And so I'm wondering if Iguodala is going to be available in game three. He might be out even longer. And if that's the case, we're going to continue to need more from Derrick Jones Jr. The ugly, and there has to be something that was ugly out of this game, aside from the officiating, which, again, you can't lay blame to. It was a very dominant topic amongst Heat Twitters. And again, I was contributing to that pretty heavily. But the constant fouling of shooters, it's something that Eric Spoelstra acknowledged in his post-game presser as well. He understands when it comes to officiating, you just focus on what you can do. And maybe it sounds cliche, but it just makes a lot of sense. You can't, again, to Matt Moore's point, you can't control the weather, so don't even bother trying. Just do what you kind of do. Try not to foul shooters and be put in that situation. There was a couple plays there where, I mean, you just, for a guy like Tyler Hero, who I think he closed out on, I can't recall now, a Milwaukee Bucks player who was rising up from the three-point shot. It looked like a ticky-tack foul, but why bother? Try and shorten your steps up a little bit. Put a hand up without necessarily getting it. And I know in the heat of the moment, and no, there's no pun intended, it's easy to leave your feet. It's easy to you know, make a play and try to stop a shooter from getting that shot off. Totally understandable. But knowing that the whistle was as tight as it was, maybe try and tweak your approach a little bit because fouling shooters in the act of shooting, and this was on both sides of the ball, both Milwaukee and Miami made some pretty bad. Look, Jimmy Butler sank two free throws because he was in the act of shooting to seal the victory. So clearly a problem for both Milwaukee and Miami. But again, control what you can. Overall, I have to say, and I'm probably going a little too long with the segment, but I'm not sure how Milwaukee responds from this. I'll probably talk about it a little bit more in tomorrow's episode. I'd like to get another episode in before Friday's Game 3 matchup. But I'm not sure what left is there for Milwaukee to do. They had a bad game from Giannis in Game 1, or maybe not a bad game, but not a great game. They got a great game from him in Game 2, and it still didn't matter. Miami just seems to have a way of responding to Milwaukee's best punches. They know how to roll with them. They know how to respond and retaliate, and that has a lot to do with their depth, the quality of their defense, the fact that they have so many capable scorers who can all step up and knock down these shots in key situations. So it's fun to see Miami playing at such a high level at just the right time here. But it also begs a question that comes from one of our readers, I'm sorry, our listeners. Is this the most overachieving team in Miami Heat history? I'll answer that and all of your listener questions in the next segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. A reminder that you can always reach me via email at lockedonheat@gmail.com or via Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat. A lot of you sent in questions tonight after the game. As always, just use that hashtag AskLOHeat. And this first question comes in from Steven. He writes, how much of an impact was having Bam Adebayo and Andre Iguodala not on the court to close? How did that affect the Heat tonight? Well, Bam, I forgot to mention earlier on, did get into foul trouble. One of those shots that Adetokounmpo converted at the end there, or one of the was trying to convert in the last couple minutes of play as a result of a foul from Bam. How did it really impact them? I don't know that it did. Like, Andre is certainly a closer, mostly for his defense, and yes, he can create plays. He can also knock down big shots as he has over the course of his career. And Bam certainly is a fulcrum for the offense because of his playmaking and everything else. But ultimately, again, as cliche as it might sound, the mentality of this team is next man up. It always is. And you've got more than enough on the floor with Jimmy, with Tyler, with Goran. These guys all know what to do. Even Jay, even though he's only been with his team for a few months, has been more than capable of hitting big shots and knowing exactly what to do at the right moment. So I don't know that you can put any of whatever that was, the chaos of the last couple of minutes, on either Bam or Andre not being there. Now, maybe they're able to do a little bit, you know, they can tweak some things defensively where a guy like Bam or Andre could shift out into Giannis Antetokounmpo and maybe he doesn't get those shot attempts. But it was so unpredictable knowing what kind of shots or what kind of aggressive moves Adetokounmpo was going to be rewarded for from by referees and get to the line and be able to knock down a couple shots. Again, he took 12 free throw attempts in game one, only hit four of those. So it's not like it was any less aggressive there. But tonight he was hitting those shots in 9 of 12, so 75% as opposed to just 33%. I don't know if there was any kind of significant impact. It's great to have two versatile defenders that you can throw at them, at the Bucks in general. Maybe you could have had Iguodala out on Middleton, but the way that play kind of shook loose there, they were kind of just scrambling. They were trying to get a shot off. It was very likely. I mean, I think watching that game and kind of thinking about it now, it felt like Miami had a pretty good lead that was not going to go away. And somehow, you know, they kept clawing back. They kept knocking down these shots. Miami made a couple mistakes in key situations. And that wound up leading to a game that was a lot closer than it probably should have. So it would have been great to have him out there. I don't know how much of an overall difference it would have made in those exact play type situations. From possession to possession moments, anybody is capable of making the right play. Even a guy like Goran, if he has to guard a Middleton. Goran's defense, again, was fine. You look at the play, I didn't see any impact. I don't think these are homer glasses. I don't think I'm viewing this with heat-colored lenses or anything like that. I didn't see much contact. He was in Middleton's face, hands straight up, didn't leave the ground. Middleton kind of leaned into him a little bit, and there was just enough contact, and he got rewarded for it. I think it was a BS call. This next question comes in from Recyclops, who asks, is this Miami Heat team the most overachieving roster in franchise history, or did we just fail to properly evaluate them, or is this just recency bias? All good points. I would say it's not the most overachieving roster. And a lot of that probably has to do with my feelings of the 2003-2004 roster and what they were able to accomplish. Just I talked about it over the summer before play began again in Orlando and during the hiatus when I took a look back at some of the best teams in Heat history. 2003-04, nobody expected anything from that group. Not only did they have a new coach in Stan Van Gundy who had taken over for Pat Riley after he abruptly resigned right before training camp or during training camp, if I recall correctly. It was right around the time that the season was set to begin. Terrible timing on Pat's part, and you're not quite sure. This was also after having acquired Lamar Odom as a free agent that year. You had a young player in Caron Butler that you had drafted out of the lottery with a 10th overall pick the year before, and then you draft some kid out of Marquette named Dwayne Wade, who was too small to play shooting guard, too big to play point guard, doesn't necessarily have the handle to do so, and you're not quite sure how to fit him alongside. You've also got an older Eddie Jones that's no longer the key scorer that he once was. You got a Brian Grant who's a tweener playing the five too often, not a big enough body to guard Shaquille O'Neal or Yao Ming or some of those players. You're not quite sure how that team is going to come together, and they did. They did so well, so effectively, and of course, Dwayne's heroics in the playoffs. Yeah, you can't say enough about what that was all about. And they overachieved completely. Nobody saw this as a playoff team, much less a team that would actually win a first-round series, which is what they did. My evaluation of this team was that they would be very good. I thought they would be a 48-win team, which is more or less what they wound up being. I thought a second-round exit seemed likely. I also saw that they had enough talent to have things break just right. I've long been a fan of the way that this team defends and plays against the Milwaukee Bucks, and we're seeing the benefits of that because, you know, clearly they are able to match with Adetokounmpo and the way that team is constructed. They have that versatility, they have that depth, and they have now a guy like Jimmy who makes it all click very, very well. The passing has been on display all season long, and it's not just the passing then. It's the fact that it leads to playmaking, that it leads to open shots for guys like Duncan and others. So I'm not saying all this to toot my own horn or anything like that. This is more or less the version of the team that I expected to see. I know I probably thought a little bit more highly of the Heat than most people did. Maybe it's just because I cover the team or saw some things early on that others did not. It's worked even better in the sense that I think there's great chemistry here. They seem to have all the pieces well. They've seen how to the ability to get the most out of Kendrick Nunn or Tyler Hero or Myers Leonard, guys that we had probably lowered expectations about and weren't quite sure that they would be able to contribute at all in many cases. And somehow they've all been able to fit in perfectly and contribute to a whole. Maybe it's like that saying, you know, the greater than the sum of their parts. You look at the parts individually, maybe they don't work, but together they've been very cohesive and effective. So that would be my answer, is that they are not the most overachieving roster in franchise history. We probably did fail to properly evaluate them. And I don't think it's necessarily recency bias either. I just think that this is a very fun team that has been very effective in both the Orlando seeding games and also during the playoffs, where they have yet to lose 6 games in. And you have other stronger contenders that have lost games against other competitors. So I know you faced a bad Indiana team or a team that was undermanned and maybe going through some turmoil internally. But at the same time, you're facing a healthy Milwaukee team. And while there have been criticisms about Mike Budenholzer, his coach, and his rotations and all these other things, the reality is you still have to fare against Giannis Antetokounmpo and the rest of that team. And Miami has certainly been able to do that through 2 games. Bizmill writes in, how was DJJ in his minutes? And if Iggy doesn't come back, do you expect DJJ to take his minutes? And how do you expect him to play in those minutes? Well, I answered most of that as far as how do you expect him to play. That's never going to be clear. Like, you never know exactly what kind of version of Derek you're going to get, unfortunately. Sometimes his shot's going to fall, other times it's not. And that's the big thing, is that I think because of Milwaukee's defense and Brook Lopez's presence in the paint, you're never going to get that lob action that we saw against the Pacers. Miles Turner is much more of a perimeter-oriented defender. He's a guy who can block shots and was doing so at a pretty high level in the bubble. But it's different. He's not the same big body that Lopez is that's clogging the paint. So I don't think Lopez is going to allow Derek to get those easy looks or lobs at the basket. And if that's the case, his offense may not be there. He might just be plugged in there as a key defensive player. And that's fine. Again, this is another player who has a clear role. If he does have an open look in the perimeter and he can knock it down and he's feeling good, take it. Why not? On Wednesday night, Derek only attempted two shots from the field, was 0 of 1 from three-point range. So clearly, at least he knows that if that shot's open, he has a green light. I think everybody in this roster does, because that's just the reality. I'll have to go back and look exactly what that shot was, but hopefully it was an open look and he took it. He missed. So what? You live with those kinds of shots because that's the strength of your offense, is being able to get out in transition and knock those shots down when they're open. And I think they did a very good job of that overall. Now, I must say also, Milwaukee, I didn't mention this in the first segment when I was talking about the differences of the game and everything else, but the points in the paint was vastly different in game two than it was in game one. Milwaukee absolutely controlled that. 52 points in the paint versus just 32 for Miami. Miami shot well from three-point range, 38%, as opposed to 28% for Milwaukee. They shot 45 attempts. A lot of their offense came from behind the line, almost, well, over half. They shot 81 total field goal attempts, so that's got to be almost 60% of their offense. I'm not doing my math here properly, but it seems like that's a whole hell of a lot of their shots that come from behind the arc. So for Derek and everybody else, Jay, Tyler, Goran, Kelly Olynyk, who provided some really nice offense in his few minutes of play, I think it's important to continue to take their shots when they're open. That's going to be the key to taking Lopez out of the game, negating his impact. If you can continue to just knock those shots down from the perimeter, forces them out there, they'll have to take him off the floor, and you'll have to put Adetokounmpo at the five, which is effective in some ways. But if Budenholzer continues to stick to what he does, and again, Miami and Eric Spoelstra, and I asked him something about this specifically after game one, and he says, look, this is who we are. You have to do what you do best. That's both correct and also a little overly simplistic, in that I think you do have to make some changes. You do have to make adjustments. Budenholzer being criticized by the Bucks fan base for not being able to make those adjustments. It just so happens that Miami's strengths play to Milwaukee's weaknesses, and they're able to exploit the things that that Milwaukee does badly. A last question comes in from Nick, who asks, what do you do when the anxiety and stress of a game take you over, and how do you come down from a game like this? Now, I have to say, I have taken a step back. I've devolved a little bit watching the Bucks series. Against the Pacers, not as emotional, not as involved in the game as I am against the Milwaukee series. I found myself feeling a lot more like a fan, watching some key plays there, getting a little pissed off at Eric Bledsoe and others as they take cheap shots at Heat players. It's been a little difficult, and the refereeing, I think, did not help. So I apologize for that, because I have not been coming across as a very unbiased reporter. But, you know, how do I come down from it? During the game, you just live with it. I don't think you have any choice. I used to pace back and forth in my living room. I don't do that anymore. I'm able to at least sit mostly calmly and take notes and try to continue to focus and tweet during the game, which is something that I have to do. As far as what I do afterwards, well, hey, I record a podcast for all of you to enjoy. So hopefully you are enjoying that, Nick, and everybody else who's listening to this show. Coming up later this week, I'll be talking to my former co-host Wes Goldberg about the Bucks series, as well as providing a recap of Game 3, which is Friday afternoon. Make sure to subscribe and follow this podcast to get the latest episode of Locked on Heat as soon as it's out. I'm David Ramil, signing off and thanking you, as always, for your support.